spirituality.
In Muslim societies, Ramadan is known as the month of God, and Muslims believe they're invited to a divine party. That's why in the holy month, humanitarian activities and charity works get supercharged, with people trying to do whatever they can to help the needy.
Muslims view Ramadan as not just a time to refrain from eating and drinking. They regard it as a chance to push the limits on humanity and become the best version of yourself as a human being. And that's what organizers here try to teach first-time fasters. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Tensions are high in the occupied territories amid a recent increase in crackdown on Palestinians. Regime forces attacked worshippers in Al-Aqsa Mosque on Friday. Scores of Palestinians were wounded in the clashes. Around 400 people were also arrested. Muslim nations as well as resistance groups have condemned Tel Aviv. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation called on the international community to force Israel to end its aggression. Iran said Friday's events in Muslims' third holiest site show that the Palestinian resistance is alive and thriving, and Israel is in a state of desperation. Analysts believe that Tel Aviv is intentionally increasing tensions to take control of Al-Aqsa Mosque.
I think that the Israelis are escalating the whole situation in the West Bank in order, at least in Jerusalem, in order to control the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And that was the aim for the settlers groups who announced many times that they wanted, to get into Al-Aqsa Mosque and practice some of their own religion kind of practices. If they did such an act, definitely that would lead to a war.
The clashes came after 3 weeks of deadly tensions in the occupied territories. Tel Aviv has deployed more forces to the West Bank and conducted raids and house searches there almost every day. This has resulted in the deaths and injuries of dozens of Palestinians. Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given Israeli forces a free hand in their operations. Many believe that the latest escalation could turn into an uprising or a new intifada in Palestine.
Palestinian experts are warning that they could return back, let's say, to more clashes, more escalation. These killings by the Israeli forces and this escalation could any time turn into an uprising or an intifada. No one can tell, especially that the Israelis are saying they will not end their operation. It will continue.
Palestinians have also increased their operations in response to the crackdown. Since March 22nd, they have conducted several stabbing and shooting operations, including one in Tel Aviv, leaving 14 Israelis dead. The increase in anti-Israel operations in the occupied territories show that Palestinians have reached a conclusion that they should decide their own fate, especially after several Arab countries normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians believe that resistance against occupation is the only way they have to achieve their goals.
People in the besieged Gaza Strip held a rally following the Friday prayers to express their solidarity with Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Angry protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and vowing to sacrifice their lives for the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Earlier, the Israeli regime forces stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Old City of Al-Quds, injuring more than 150 worshippers during the second Friday of the fasting holy month of Ramadan. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
We are prepared to wage wars for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will continue to the equation of arms for arms and blood for blood, and that Al-Quds is a red line that must not be crossed. The Israeli occupation will bear for responsibility for any repercussions as a result of its attacks against the worshippers. We are ready for all scenarios to stop this enemy and protect our people.
Protesters in the Gaza Strip vow to increase their solidarity with Al-Quds until the removal of all Israeli violations in the holy city.
The Palestinian people are united for the sake of Al-Quds, and we will not abandon Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will fight for the sake of Al-Quds and sacrifice our lives for it.
The Israeli regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression in Al-Quds since the beginning of Ramadan. Palestinian resistance factions warned the Israeli regime of dire consequences if Israeli forces continue to attack Al-Quds.
The Israeli is sending a clear message to the Zionist enemy that it must understand that we will not sit idle while it attacks Al-Quds. The Zionist enemy is playing with fire and it will only explode in its face.
The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal enclave say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The latest second-round polls in France continue to show that Emmanuel Macron's once comfortable lead has vanished to make the race a dead heat. The mainstream media's insistence on talking about Islamophobia and xenophobia has already produced near-record abstention, but the unrest in Ukraine has forced real issues back to the fore. First the Great Recession, then the Age of Austerity, then the Yellow Vest Civil War, then the coronavirus era, and now an era of Russian sanctions? Devoted Europhile Macron remains committed to a long-term blockade of Russia, which requires years of economic suffering for the average household. Analysts say that voters may prefer Le Pen's France First insistence that any Russia sanctions not bankrupt French homes and businesses.
She's a nationalist, and she's protectionist in some way. She's also protective. She has understood that it was important to sound as someone that would be here to take care of electors. It's whether it's for good or bad, but a lot of French people want to feel that they have a protective hand in government.
Le Pen has also promised to pull out of NATO's command center to restore French independence. Macron is relying on a demonization campaign of the National Front, just like in 2017. When the number two reason people voted for Macron was to block them from coming to power.
He is, in a way, a president by default. The number one paradox of this campaign is that, indeed, we've had 5 years of a president who's managed to be disliked by almost everybody and who yet is favored to be reelected.
Back when he thought victory was assured, Macron promised to raise the retirement age to 65 this fall. That may cost him key older and left-wing votes. He's backtracking and saying that he's now willing to listen to the ideas and desires of voters. Do left-wing voters believe Macron's claims that he's now willing to govern by consensus? Does France view Le Pen differently after 5 years of Macronism? The winning candidate may be the one who proves that they have changed the most since the very different year of 2017. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
Arms trafficking at Italy's main sea dispatch points is ongoing in breach of international and Italian laws. Dockers have found U.S.-made tanks in the hold of a Saudi ship docked at the port of Genoa. Our correspondent Max Civili has this report from Rome.
Italian ports have often been central to international arms trafficking over the past years. Cargos of weapons destined for war-torn countries have been intercepted in various seaports, including those of Livorno, Naples and Gioia Tauro. On Wednesday, dockers belonging to the autonomous port workers collective CALP found tanks in the hold of the Saudi Arabian ship Bahri Jeddah, which is moored in the Italy's northern port of Genoa. CALP dockers have taken photos of the weapons placed on board the ship and published them on the collective's website.
The ship carries weapons and ammunition. We spotted M1 Abrams tanks already armed, produced in the US. On the deck of the ship, there are also containers full of ammunition and explosives in plain sight. It is extremely dangerous and against international and Italian laws.
About 10 days ago, CALP dockers, together with rights associations and pacifist movements, staged a protest demanding the port authority more transparency on ships' cargoes transiting in Genoa. Dockers have said the demands have not yet been addressed.
These ships carrying cargo of arms and explosives are not just operating in breach of international and Italian laws. Cargo of this sort is extremely dangerous for the dockers and for thousands of people living in the surroundings of the port of Genoa. In addition to that, ships are moored near a chemical warehouse and an oil depot. You can imagine the safety implications of that.
The Weapon Watch Observatory has also found that the number of Italian aircraft carriers that are transporting weapons towards Poland has dramatically increased over the past weeks. Rome has been sending tons of arms and humanitarian aid to Ukraine since the start of the conflict there. The arms industry in Italy is prospering. 10 years ago, Rome was the 10th largest weapons producer in the world. Today it stands as the 6th. Furthermore, following the start of the conflict in Ukraine, the Mario Draghi government has honored a pledge made to NATO a few years ago, rising military spending from 1.4 to 2% of GDP by 2028. Max Civili, Rome.
Millions of EU citizens are really starting to feel the pinch. Inflation in the 19-country eurozone is currently at 7.5%. The European Central Bank, ECB, wants inflation to be at just below 2%. It means the cost of living is out of control.
The impact of the war on the economy will depend on how the conflict evolves, on the effect of current sanctions, and on possible further measures.
On Thursday, the ECB said energy prices have increased by 45% in the past 12 months. Business and consumer confidence has fallen through the floor due to the conflict in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia. There are major supply issues. The cost of living is rising, but wages are not, according to the ECB. We have been speaking to EU citizens.
We have also a lot of refugees in Poland, so it's also a huge problem now for our country, for the healthcare system and every other area.
We have to take the car, we're trying to take everybody at the same place and try to share with other peoples, and of course everything in the food also. I mean, it's a big problem, yeah.
When I drive with a car or something, and yeah, the prices went so high, as a student I cannot pay it.
If the Ukrainian conflict continues, there will be problem because Russian and Ukraine are two of the most important food producers, so there will be problem about food price.
And as a business person, are you worried about losing your business?
Yeah, it's stopping if you don't have the parts to construct your thing.
The next update from the European Central Bank is scheduled to take place on the 9th of June. So how badly could things possibly deteriorate for EU citizens between now and then? To quote the head of the bank, Christine Lagarde, who knows? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kabat Ahwai. Dozens of Israeli military forces have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and restricted the entry of Palestinians. They secured the incursion of hundreds of extremist settlers to mark the Passover holiday. Why is the Al-Aqsa such a flashpoint between Palestinians and Israelis? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the continuing raids by Israeli forces desecrating Islam's holiest site. This is while Israeli tanks and armored vehicles have made an incursion into northern Gaza Strip, raising the specter of another war in the besieged territory. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. You're a British former MP and the host of Palestine Declassified show on Press TV, Chris Williamson, who joins us from Derby, the UK. Also an activist with the Answer Coalition and author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, Richard Becker joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, I'd like to welcome you both, and let me first start with you, Chris Williamson, if I may. We're looking at another raid by the Israeli military forces on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, restricted the entry of Palestinians, which is customary. They secured, in this case, the incursion of hundreds of these settlers, or extremist settlers, as some call, to mark the Passover holiday. Tell us why this particular, Ramadan, is different than the other ones. Based on the fact that you have a convergence here of, for example, Passover and the Ramadan together?
I think I got the sense of your question, but this is clearly an appalling and outrageous desecration by the Israeli occupation forces. And it's yet another example, really, how Zionism is inconsistent with decency. And the way the Zionist state operates, it seems that they think they are literally a law unto themselves, that they can basically do what they wish without any consequences. And it really is important, I think, for the world community to step up. I mean, we know that they have been subjected to, I think it's around 45 condemnatory UN resolutions. But where is the follow-through? And this is what I think is so important. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, Israeli operates as a sort of a rogue state, a terrorist state, you might say, actually. It is certainly, in my opinion, deserving of sanctions that should be imposed by the international community against them.
Well, if we want to take a look at the reasons why, Richard Becker, there's a restriction for access of the Palestinians to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Tell us, if you can, or give to us a brief history check as to what significance Al-Aqsa has for the Muslims and why it is that Israel is restricting them, especially like this month, which is obviously one of the most important, holiest months for Muslims.
Well, I think that what's going on at Al-Aqsa, and I agree with the comments by your other guests, that what's going on at Al-Aqsa is part of the de-Arabization drive that's going on in Jerusalem. It has to be done step by step, but clearly the attack on the Palestinians, particularly in East Jerusalem, but all over Palestine, but particularly at the moment, in East Jerusalem and what's been going on in Silwan, what happened last year at Al-Aqsa, where now it's said that 160,000 Palestinians gathered in defiance of Israel at that time and in support of the Palestinians who are being evicted. So I think we see these things all as connected. There's, of course, the religious significance that the Al-Aqsa Mosque is considered, I believe, the third most holy site of Islam. And so when the attacks happen on Al-Aqsa, it's not seen just as an attack on Palestinians, but on Muslims all over the world. And I think should be viewed as an attack on justice by everyone who stands for justice in the world. So we have this going on, and of course, the part of the story is that East Jerusalem, when the 1948 war, the armistice happened in the 1948 war, East Jerusalem was placed under Jordanian rule, along with the West Bank at that time, and since that 1967, when the rest of what had been the British Mandate of Palestine was conquered, there was an agreement between the Israeli government, the occupying government, and the Jordanian monarchy about governance of the Al-Aqsa site and the plaza, the Temple Mount, as the Israelis call it, the noble sanctuary, as the Palestinians call it. But there was an agreement that there would be a process for dealing with any issues that arose, including who could come to the mosque, who could come to the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa. And we can see that the Jordanian government yesterday and today is saying those agreements have been broken, that the Israeli police are accompanying groups of extreme right-wing settlers onto the grounds of the mosque. And this is seen as a grave, grave insult by the Palestinians and I think by Muslims all over the world.
Uh-huh. Well, that's one of the things I'd like to ask you, if I can, Chris Williamson, about these extreme settlers, or what I'm looking at is one of the facts that I'm asking you whether it's correct or not, far-right Jewish groups, as one report has indicated, that are actually calling not only for the raids at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Jewish Passover holiday. It also states that this includes the offering of animal sacrifices in the courtyards, which is not something that's occurred in a long time. I mean, is it hard for an outsider to see how much of an insult that would be to Muslims when something like this is happening, if it's true or not?
Well, the truth is that the settlers are absolute extremists, and we've seen the sort of actions that they've taken against the Palestinian people. They treat the Palestinian people with utter contempt, and they're protected really by the Israeli occupation forces. And so, I mean, some of the images which I've seen at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, I mean, it's just beyond anything, frankly. I mean, it's so repulsive. We've seen, and not just the settlers either, of course. I mean, we've actually seen police, the Israeli police security services attacking worshippers, attacking children, beating women. I mean, attacking disabled people, throwing disabled people to the floor. Of course, this isn't anything new. We've seen this on a relatively regular basis. They're absolutely horrific images. And what really annoys me, frankly, is the way in which the Western media seem to draw a veil over these atrocities, which is what they are, and often try and draw a sort of equivalence and suggest that the appalling attacks that we're seeing, officially sanctioned, it seemed, by the Zionist state, referring to them as clashes. I mean, clashes are an astonishing description by the Western media when you think about it, because we're talking about people, worshippers there, just in regular everyday clothing, being attacked by people who are heavily armed, being attacked by security services, people they've got body armor on and so on, and beating and just treating Palestinian people with utter contempt. And frankly, as I say, the international community is culpable here because they haven't spoken out sufficiently enough. It's all very well, and it's welcome that the resolutions have been passed by the United Nations, but there needs to be follow through. And that follow through, in my opinion, should be BDS. I mean, that is really the very minimum that we should be demanding from the world's community, from the international community.
Sure, indeed. Sure. Well, let's take one of the things that you talked about, and that is the heavy-handed tactics, I believe, that you said is exercised by the Israelis here. And Richard Becker, what the Knesset members actually have demanded, believe it or not, is to have a heavy-handed, what they call a so-called law and order approach to deal with the Palestinian demonstrators, as they're calling it. Now, I'm looking at an instance of a 17-year-old who was shot in the abdomen, and this happened in Jenin, actually. The injuries suggested that this Palestinian was struck with an exploding bullet that ruptured his vessels and veins, in which you have the Children International Palestine stating the use of expanding and exploding bullets is a violation of, obviously, international humanitarian law. Is that what they mean by a law and order approach?
Yeah, we're very familiar in the United States with what the term law and order actually means. It means repression. It means unleashing the police and the repressive forces. And, you know, this has a long history here. Nixon ran for president in 1968 on a platform, Richard Nixon, on a platform of law and order. And what that meant was unleashing the police against the growing anti-war demonstrations and anti-racism demonstrations that were taking place. No one has had any doubt since that time, I don't think, about what anyone means, any politician means in the United States or elsewhere when they talk about law and order. But, you know, when I think connected to that is the, and your other guest was referring to the use of the term clashes. Well, also there's the use of the word violence, because violence in the lexicon of the U.S. media and the Israeli media only comes into play when there's resistance by the Palestinians. The greatest violence can be done day in and day out by the Israeli occupying forces, the military, the police, and so forth, and it's not called violence. It's only violence when there's the resistance and the people, the Palestinian people, are fighting back. So, you know, it's important to understand, I think, this vocabulary, because it's not just over the term violence, but over many, many terms in the way that they're used to convey. And what they convey really is that what the Israeli military does and what the Israeli police do is legitimate, but what the Palestinians do is not legitimate. And that's the impression that is really passed on to the people here by the mainstream media, the corporate media, every single day of the week. So we only hear the terminology of violence in times of resistance. And then when the Israelis strike back against any resistance that takes place, or they strike against it, then it's called retaliation. And retaliation implies that it's justified self-defense. You're retaliating against someone who's attacking you. But that turns reality completely on its head. It's the Palestinians who are under attack every day and face the Israeli violence. And it is they who suffer. It is they who go to prison, administrative detention, torture, deprivation of their land, of their resources, and so forth. So it's a very twisted approach. And, you know, I just would add also that a number of journalists had broken arms who were clearly journalists and then were attacked by the Israeli police in the Al-Aqsa area.
So, Chris Williamson, how do you deal then with this when we know how influential Israel is when it comes to media and how much they've penetrated the narrative? Because they're coming out saying things like, in terms of the spin, like the police raid was an effort to protect the freedom of worship from what they called violent rioters desecrating the site. That's how they're describing it, and endangering the public. But we know of videos that show otherwise, and I can name you countless examples that I'm sure you're familiar with of what happened actually inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So how do you deal with the false narrative, if I may say so, of the way Israel is presenting that to the media, and then, of course, the media to the world?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's so important that we do speak out. Obviously, you know, we have this platform. But, you know, in this day and age with the use of the emergence of social media, that does give us an opportunity, although we know that, you know, big tech is sort of using, manipulating the algorithms, as it were, to limit these progressive messages about the Palestinian struggle. But I think people are increasingly aware, frankly, of the abuse, the brutality, the routine brutality of the Israeli state. And, you know, I think we can cut through to some extent, and, you know, through the use of these alternative platforms, alternative media platforms, you know, raise consciousness about what is actually happening now. And of course, you know, people on the ground, thanks to the, you know, use of things like what I'm holding in my hand now, these smart phones can actually record this. And this has been, you know, much of the shocking images that we've seen on our screens, through on our social media platform, let's be honest, is as a consequence, frankly, of citizen journalism. I mean, you know, Palestinians on the ground are actually able to record what is actually happening. And so that message is now spreading, and we're able, to a greater extent than we've ever been, I think, to cut through the narrative, the dominant narrative, regrettably, in the corporate media. And I think an example of that, really, of how that is cutting through, was visible last year when Israel were engaged in that terrible bombardment of Gaza yet again. And in towns and cities across the United Kingdom and indeed across the world, people were coming out in unprecedented numbers to express their revulsion, their horror at what Israel were doing. And I give my own city of Derby in the middle of the United Kingdom. It was the biggest rally that Derby has ever seen in its history. There were literally thousands and thousands of people on the street showing their support and solidarity to the Palestinian people. But we've got to go further than that. We've got to do more than that. That's important, of course, to raise that consciousness, to raise that awareness amongst the general public. Where that isn't cutting through, regrettably, is within the political class, in certainly in the United Kingdom, on both sides of the House of Commons chamber. We know that the Zionist lobby is incredibly influential, incredibly powerful. I think around, for example, in the so-called official opposition, the Labour Party, I think around half the members of Parliament are members of a parliamentary group called the Labour Friends of Israel. And so what we need to do is to translate that increased consciousness, I think, which we're seeing in the wider general public, into political action. And that's where I think, you know, it's up to people like myself and others, activists in the Palestine movement, Palestine Solidarity Movement, to mobilise that support on the ground, to put pressure on our politicians, and indeed, if necessary, to replace them with people who take a anti-imperialist stance and to actually, you know, push for justice for the Palestinian people. This is a, you know, this is an injustice, an outrage, which has been going on, as we know, for over 70 years. And, you know, we see all this outpouring in the media for Ukraine. And yet, you know, Israel has been subject to unprecedented brutality for all those decades. And, you know, I'm hoping that we can, as I say, translate that support, which is now being articulated, as I say, on the ground, ordinary rank and file people, into that sort of political action. That's where I think is going to be so important.
Richard Becker, I can't help to think when we have a guest there, Chris Williamson, talk about how last year when the war on Gaza broke out, which, by the way, was because of what happened during the month of Ramadan, and, of course, the violence incurred on Palestinians and their resistance led to that war. Although that's very encouraging to hear, why isn't the same being done by people in the Arab world, citizens from the Arab countries? For example, in Jordan, they did come out in droves based on what has occurred. Of course, it's not just Al-Aqsa raids, but also the raids that happened in Jenin, for example, leading to Palestinian deaths. But my question to you is the lack of enthusiasm to come out in support of Palestinians, especially if you're a Palestinian and you see that your leaders are normalizing ties with Israel.
Yeah, you know, that's a really important point, because I think that what has come out, what we can see, especially from the meeting that took place in Israel, Bahrain, the foreign ministers of Bahrain and Egypt and the UAE, Israel, the United States, that was another green light to the repressive forces, to the repression against the Palestinian people. And you know, what it brought out was something that the progressive movement in progressives in Palestine have said for a very long time, that their enemy is not only Israel, the Zionist state, and U.S. imperialism and the other imperialist countries, but also the reactionary Arab regimes, which have collaborated secretly and are now collaborating openly with Israel at the behest of the United States. And these are the most reactionary governments on the face of the earth, along with them, Saudi Arabia, which is a quiet, wasn't part of this meeting, but very much Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain. These are family monarchies, which are extremely repressive. And if you oppose them, you know, people face torture and death for any kind of opposition. But I think that now we have a clearer picture of the fact that it is a kind of a three-headed monster that the Palestinian people and the Arab people as a whole, I would say, face in their struggle for justice and self-determination. But especially this is who and what the Palestinian people really confront. I would just add one thing, that last year when Gaza happened, there were demonstrations all over the United States, including many places that first demonstrations had been the year before, the George Floyd demonstrations, when over 5,000 cities and towns had demonstrations in the U.S. And that experience brought people into the streets again, having had the experience and how to do demonstrations. And also there was the long term out here in San Francisco that we were part of, was the Block the Boat to prevent the unloading of the Israeli shipping cargo. And that ranged all up and down the West Coast of the United States and Canada. So I do think that the movement in solidarity with the Palestinian people is growing. It needs to grow more. That's the only way that I think we're ever going to see justice, is a movement of solidarity with the struggle that's going on there, and to call to question and to demand that the government of the United States cease its aid, its support to the Israeli state.
You got 30 seconds here. Unfortunately, Chris Williamson, the risk of war happening on the Gaza Strip. We know that Israeli tanks have rolled into the northern part of the Gaza Strip just today. Do you think that the possibility of war has escalated based on all the violence that has happened?
It's a concern, certainly, and it's something that we need to be vigilant about and indeed speak out against. But look, I think the unipolar world is coming to an end. You know, the domination of the United States is in a downward sort of spiral, I believe, and I think, you know, a multipolar world may have some spin-off benefits. I certainly hope it will.
Okay.
for the liberation of the Palestinian people, and that's what I think we need to work for.
Pleasure. Thank you, Chris Williamson from Derby, UK, British former MP and host of Palestine Declassified show on Press TV, and also from San Francisco, Richard Becker. Thank you. An activist with Answer Coalition and author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahvay, it's goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, lived in Yakhshal Ghazi neighborhood of Qom for 20 years, and the house had turned into a center of knowledge and political struggles of the Imam. In fact, the father of the Islamic Revolution authored many of his books and also composed a remarkable part of his poems in the same house. Imam Khomeini and his wife experienced many sweet and bitter events in this house. However, writing of the book Kashful Asrar was a very effective event during those years, which we are going to touch upon in this episode. Stay tuned, please.
Thank you.
Kashful Asrar, or Uncovering of Secrets, was the name of a book which Imam Khomeini wrote in response to some religious and ideological ambiguities that had been raised in 1944 by a certain Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh in his blasphemous book 1,000 Years Secrets. Hakamizadeh was a student of seminary but had reactionary and deviated thoughts. He had lived with Khasravi, an anti-religious figure. Under the influence of Khasravi, Hakamizadeh left the seminary and went to the U.S. while he no more wore the clergy clothes. Hakamizadeh had authored the book 1,000 Years Secrets in order what he considered to remove superstitions from Islam. Yet the book fomented rifts among people and made people suspicion on the authenticity of Islam. The publication of the book caused special jurisprudential and political debates among ulema and the seminary students. Nevertheless, it was Imam Khomeini who sensed the danger of this blasphemous and seditionist book and wrote Kashful Asrar to show the Shia clergy community's serious reaction to the conspiracy. Imam Khomeini's responses to Hakamizadeh were so broad and harsh that he hid with no trace in history. Imam Khomeini answered the anti-religious, anti-clergy propaganda of the book 1,000 Years Secrets. He discussed historical events and critically discussed the views of the ancient and contemporary Greek philosophers to emphasize the rightfulness and constructive role of the Shia ulema and seminaries. Imam Khomeini's book not only defended the Shia ideas, but revealed the basis of his political practice in the years of a struggle. The Imam explicitly says in the book that the only legitimate rule is the divine rule. In response to Hakamizadeh's claim that there is no reason to say that a jurisprudent is entitled to rule, Imam Khomeini wrote that the jurisprudential principles are mainly the narrations and hadith of the infallible imams, and they, in turn, are connected to the Prophet and the divine revelation. The imam deducted from a number of hadith that so it is clear that those who narrate the practice and hadith of the Prophet are the Prophet's representatives, and whatever is proved for the Prophet of the necessity to obey them, Wilayat and rule are proved for them. Because if a ruler introduces a representative for himself, it means he must do his jobs in his absence. Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was closely witnessing the imam's concerns over the book 1,000 Years Secrets. He says to this is the imam's thought. The imam who thinks in this way on rule, studies, and teaches Irfan, you know, Islamic Gnosticism. You know that those who pursue the issues of philosophy and Gnosticism are not after such things like rule and vice versa. But he has staged uprising in two fronts. Firstly, in the front of a struggling, the sanctimonious who washed the jar that our son Mustafa had drunk water from because the imam was a teacher of philosophy. However, the imam stood against these towns and taught philosophy and clashed with the thought which considered philosophy as haram and opened the way for the next teachers. On the other hand, he was preoccupied with formation of the Islamic rule and didn't stop for a moment to establish God's religion. As for the tough issues which occurred during political events, he would intervene but he would spend his effort and talents in studying and discussion, as he believed that there were great ulema at the seminary and basic responsibility is up to them, and he should get prepared for the future, and he had to study to achieve easier what he was thinking about. One of the moral characteristics of Imam Khomeini was the high respect he observed for the ulema and jurisprudence of seminary while writing the book Uncovering of Secrets, Kashf al-Asrar, although he was opposed to some of their political thoughts. His wife says that he always had a combative spirit. During the reign of Reza Khan, he was constantly in pain and hardship. When Reza Khan wanted to remove turbans, the imam was among those who spent days in gardens and nights in his room. He was not a person to surrender to Reza Khan with such threats. Late Sheikh Abdul Karim, who believed in silence, hadn't been able to force the spirit of this unyielding man to be silent against Reza Khan's coercion. Although he himself behaved so and trained some on his basis, a group of others who were few in number, and Mr. Khomeini was among them, didn't accept his method. She continues, "The defenseless people would go and give the reports of injustices of the agents of Reza Khan, and Sheikh Abdul Karim would keep silent as if nothing had happened. He believed that silence was better. At the time of the seminary students' exams, which had been determined by the regime, the Sheikh not only didn't prevent them, but he encouraged them to take the exams. The Imam had differences with late Ayatollah Borujerdi too, but he would never say anything, as he considered respect the respect of Islam. He would always respect Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim too." Here, Imam Khomeini's wife has pointed to the exams of seminary students, which was related to the law that had been passed during Reza Khan's reign for exempting from military service only the students who could pass the exam which the regime would give. This way, it was the court mullahs who proved the scientific qualification of students, not the great teachers and sources of emulation.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.